its premiere of FedSoc Films' latest movie, Jawboned, Misinformation versus Free Speech. When I started working on this issue back in 2019, I never imagined I'd find myself at a big-budget movie premiere, a red chair premiere, perhaps not a red carpet, about jawboning. The issue seemed too diffuse, too arcane, not something everyday people would be interested in. But this movie really changes that. I think you'll see in a few minutes that FedSoc Studios have done a wonderful job at bringing this issue to life, making it approachable, accessible. And with that, enjoy the show.
Misinformation is widespread.
Concerns around spreading misinformation.
It was revealed that the Biden administration worked with YouTube in 2021 to censor, quote, vaccine misinformation.
So I actually first came across the term jawboning, I want to say last year or this year, so 2022 or 2023. But it was happening to us at Facebook. We just didn't call it that.
Sometimes government officials try to get around the First Amendment's constraints by informally influencing other private actors to take action against our speech for them. This censorship laundering phenomenon is what we call jawboning.
So in the world that I work in, that oftentimes was trying to pressure social media companies to try to take action on different types of content with the underlying veil of, if you don't do this, we might make your life difficult, you know, we might regulate you, etc.
In my observation, you know, I think that jawboning is a bipartisan exercise. And I think in some ways it's become that way because it works. It has an impact.
Well, the government can speak, it can attempt to inform, but when it starts pressuring private actors to do things that the government itself can't do, in this case to censor speech, you have a problem.
The distinction between permissible convincing, with which falls squarely in the camp of normal political advocacy, and unconstitutional coercion is the million-dollar question. The court will resolve this term in Murthy v. Missouri and NRA v. Volo.
The term was originally used or applied to the activities of the Board of Price Control during the Second World War. They didn't have formal power to set prices, but they could go around calling people unpatriotic for failing to rein in and control their prices during wartime. The phrase was then applied to the activities of presidents attempting to control prices after the war. Their speech, their words aimed at these private companies to get them to lower or stop raising their prices were likened to Samson's vengeance on the Philistines in the Book of Judges. There, he claims, "With the jawbone of an ass, I have slain 1,000 men." And the words of these presidents and other officials were them using their own ass's jawbone in an attempt to control prices and browbeat companies into changing their behavior.
Social media has come a long way since the last election, and it's not likely to catch anyone by surprise. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube have all developed into mainstream platforms, and for presidential candidates, left, right, and center, having a robust social media strategy is the only way to go now.
Back in this country, the Obama administration's innovation proposal. President Obama made his case on a high-tech visit to the West Coast.
Well, social media is no longer optional. Having a sound social media strategy is critical to winning a presidential election.
From 2012 to 2016, you had so many elected officials who wanted to go to Silicon Valley. They wanted to get the tours. They wanted to be looked as though they were tech savvy, because everything that the tech companies were touching kind of turned to gold. They were the favorite children. And then things started to change.
It wasn't until after 2016, when you have real anxieties about foreign misinformation and a lack of clear authority and as to what or who is responsible for doing something about it, that you get a lot of jawboning, that it becomes normalized in Congress and in Washington.
people also start to have more questions about, wait, what power do these platforms have over our citizens? How much persuasiveness or sway could they have over our economy and other things, particularly the election of President Trump being such a shock for people? Many people, the first questions coming out of that election were, how did President Trump win? How did he use platforms like Facebook to do so?
Facebook has come under fire recently for its role in last year's election. Reports have surfaced showing the social networking site was a breeding ground for misinformation.
And there you have Dianne Feinstein really kicking off the age of social media jawboning, telling platform representatives,
you bear this responsibility. You've created these platforms, and now they are being misused. And you have to be the ones to do something about it, or we will.
After 2016, and then particularly when COVID happened, you started to see governments more starting to push the companies on what types of content they were allowing around how people could stay safe with the vaccine and also voting procedures and stuff of that nature.
The coronavirus crisis leading to another dangerous outbreak that some are calling an infodemic.
We're seeing challenges around information quality that we've never seen before. The reality is, I think we used to have a lot more agreement in society about what constituted truth and facts, and so we didn't argue as much about those kinds of things. You have really a battle going on over, you know, what role social media and online platforms have in policing truth.
The social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have been trying to limit the spread of disinformation, but it's more complicated than it appears.
When looking at the information environment, we all have a role to play. Us as individuals have a role to play to understand what our media diet is, to make sure that if something sounds kind of fishy, that we're maybe looking for backup sources of what it might be. Understanding that we need to make sure that we're looking for a dateline on a story. Does it have a byline? Who is it that shared it? Not just immediately believing everything that we do see. But we can't do all of that on our own.
Trust the science? Well, it sure seems like the science can't always be trusted. A new terrifying report from The Guardian indicates that research credibility is at an all-time low as a rash of fake papers made their way into the academy, into prestigious journals.
There's been such disagreement about what kind of problem disinformation or hate speech are that we haven't seen that kind of agreement over any one solution. So when government officials take it upon themselves to jawbone about the problems they see, they may be addressing legitimate issues, oversights by platforms, but they're doing so as lone guns out on their own without any real sanction to legitimate that kind of behavior.
Government officials communicating about their political agenda, including strong criticism of private actors and proposing policy changes in response to the undesirable policy action, is core to what they do. Indeed, it's even necessary for our governors to govern. The problem is when they try to manipulate constitutionally protected private action in ways that ordinarily require legislation or formal regulatory power.
That lack of due process makes jawboning really problematic, even if you might agree with the sentiment or concern. Maybe platforms should remove more disinformation. But they shouldn't be doing so because some politician has threatened another aspect of their business.
You have to look at this rather than individual times that this is happening and how every time it happens, it continues to build upon itself. And this pressure can get to a point because governments do have a bigger bully pulpit. I think the best example is when President Biden said that Facebook was killing people because it wasn't taking down certain COVID content. That causes pain onto these companies where they now have PR problems. They have maybe users that are going away. And that is a power that a government has that a regular user might not have or others may not have as well.
Behind the sunny snapshots on Instagram and the jovial threads of conversation on Facebook and Twitter, a hidden army of content moderators toils to keep these digital public spaces from descending into the worst the internet has to offer.
Content moderation is also known as editorial judgment, which is itself speech within the ambit of the First Amendment's protection. This means that whenever the government tries to manipulate their exercise of editorial judgment, they inflict a constitutional injury on the social media network. Users on private social media networks do not have a right categorically to have their content left up. The private network retains ultimate discretion over what content stays and what content goes. But users do have a right to content moderation made free of undue government interference.
Jawboning is difficult because government has so many ways to potentially punish non-compliant platforms or businesses. You can bring antitrust action, you can bring investigations around labor standards. Platforms may have executives or officials dragged in front of Congress and browbeaten with effects on their stock price that, you know, their competitors don't have because they towed the line and they weren't brought in for the drubbing.
It's always a veiled message that if you don't do what we say that we want you to do, that we might take these actions. And so there's always this sort of cat and mouse game and having to figure out if the government... how real is that threat that they might take action or not?
Companies have blind spots. They might be blind to politics. They might be blind to culture. They might be blind to regional differences. And they themselves might not have the staff that reflects all of their user base. And in those cases, you know, policymakers flagging things for platforms to take a closer look at, that can be valuable.
Social media companies make it clear that not all contact from the government relating to content moderation is unwelcome. In fact, many of them have invested substantially in what we call trusted flagger portals. They invite the government, particularly the FBI, to flag for them content related to national security matters, to election disinformation.
I also think it's worth keeping in mind that every elected official represents someone, right? And so they are elected by the people. They're going to carry that voice, and sometimes that's going to lead them to prod platforms. The question is, does it go too far into the kind of the realm of coercion?
I think it's so difficult to determine when ordinary government speech becomes unconstitutional jawboning because the state of the law on jawboning from about five or six cases that have made their way up to federal appellate courts is a series of inscrutable dichotomies. These dichotomies include that the government can convince but not coerce, criticize but not threaten, persuade but not intimidate, recommend but not demand or command, and advise but not require. And it turns out parsing one end of the binary from the other involves a lot of very, very subjective judgment.
Republicans allege the platforms have an anti-conservative bias. They question the social media giant's actions regarding the New York Post stories about President-elect Joe Biden's son Hunter in the lead-up to the election.
The previous regime at Twitter spoke publicly about their regrets about how they handled the New York Post Hunter Biden story right before the election, and in retrospect, maybe wouldn't have acted the way that they did based on what later came out.
Not every example of jawboning is going to be as neat and tidy as White House advisor Andy Slavitt telling Meta that the White House is looking into its options as to what to do about the platform's reticence.
None of the platforms want to be seen as helping foment insurrection. None of the platforms want to be seen as making a public health crisis worse. You know, they want to behave in a socially responsible way, and they're going to make decisions that not everybody's going to agree with. But I do think that, you know, they should preserve the ability to make those decisions and free of, you know, undue government pressure.
If the government can achieve by proxy what the First Amendment prohibits it from achieving directly, we have a sort of constitutional dead zone where the government is free to pursue its policy objectives without having to clear the legislative process, but more importantly, without having to clear constitutional scrutiny.
Crucially, when you have jawboning going on, when it's known that this is occurring, when government actors are collaborating with platforms to remove this or that unwanted truth. We can't trust anything we see online. We must always expect that something is being kept from us and that the available information has been pre-pruned by someone else.
The Supreme Court getting ready to weigh in on whether or not the federal government violated the First Amendment when it pressured social media platforms to take down what it claimed was misleading content about the pandemic and the 2020 election.
Murthy v. Missouri is the first time the Supreme Court will take a crack at social media jawbone. It comes out of a case called Missouri v. Biden, in which Missouri and Louisiana sued the Biden administration and the CDC on behalf of a group of doctors who felt as though their content, skeptical of vaccines, had been censored by social media platforms at the behest of or in response to government demands that they crack down on COVID misinformation.
NRA v. Volo is another jawboning case before the Supreme Court this term that also concerns the extent to which the government can, in some way, intimidate private third-party business relationships in order to get at end First Amendment-protected speech. Murthy v. Missouri and Volo pose virtually the same legal question to the court. But the two lower courts teed up the question under totally different bodies of law. The Fifth Circuit and the Biden SG teed it up under a case called Bloom v. Uretsky, and the Second Circuit teed it up under a case called Bantam Books v. Sullivan.
These two cases set very different thresholds or bars for finding either jawboning or government action.
In Bantam Books v. Sullivan, the court held that an implicitly threatening letter from a commission that did not itself have enforcement authority was sufficient to create a scheme of informal censorship that had the effect of violating the First Amendment. What this establishes is that it shouldn't be unduly difficult for plaintiffs to seek redress. It doesn't have to be a direct threat of adverse regulatory action from a very high-ranking executive official. Bantam Books also made clear that the proper defendant in jawboning suits is the source of the constitutional injury.
In Blum v. Uretsky, however, the court found that the state can only be held responsible for a private decision when they've exercised coercive power or provided such significant encouragement that the choice must be deemed to be that of the state.
If the court agrees with the Fifth Circuit and the Biden administration that Bloom v. Uretsky is the appropriate framework, what this will do is set an unduly high bar for future plaintiffs to obtain redress against the government, and it will induce them to name the wrong defendant. The appropriate defendant is always the one who inflicted the constitutional injury, that is the government.
It's important to say about the Murthy case is even if the government were to lose in that case, it would probably only curtail the executive branch's jawboning of online platforms. So I don't see Congress being affected by that case.
Volo is a reminder, though, that jawboning is a much bigger problem than just in the social media context, and that it's not just a problem concerning federal officials. Superintendent Volo was a New York State political official.
There probably isn't a Goldilocks line that is going to perfectly prohibit all untoward government jawboning while allowing innocent or benevolent government information attempts. So instead, if we can't sort all of the bad from all of the good, the best thing to do is to make it all public.
I think that a ruling from the court is going to have to be a multi-factor kind of context-sensitive analysis. I think courts faced with these realize quickly that a bright line rule is likely to result in absurd outcomes. These are by nature context-specific inquiries.
I really hope that the Supreme Court does not throw the baby out with the bathwater, because we do need to be able to have ways for the government to talk to social media companies.
You aren't going to see the Supreme Court impose a disclosure regime on government communications with platforms from the top down. they might, and I think ought to, hint at the value of Congress doing such a thing in their decision. But ultimately, that's a role for Congress.
Well, I think a broad ruling that government could never speak to platforms could make platforms much less equipped to deal with broad-scale propaganda campaigns, misinformation campaigns by foreign governments and bad actors. And that would be a really bad result. We want that kind of information to be shared. But is there some kind of line that can be drawn to ensure that the government sharing that information doesn't become coercive or isn't an inappropriate use of the government's power? Perhaps. And we'll see what happens in the case.
Yeah, this really is the million-dollar question. I hope the Supreme Court can answer, because the rest of us can't.
For that spectacular film. Well, I want to thank you all for coming out to this premiere of Jawboned. It was a wonderful film. I'm looking forward to an even better conversation with some of the folks who were in the film and produced and directed the film. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion. Just a reminder up front that we will be doing Q&A at the end. So if you've got questions, I think this is online. If you do, submit those questions online, and I'll be able to access them and ask the panel. And toward the end, we'll also be taking questions. So be thinking about those questions as we have this conversation, and we will get to that after we have a bit of discussion. So I'll start by introducing myself, because I'm the only one you don't maybe know anything about. My name's David Nasera. I'm a fellow for Free Expression and Technology here at the Cato Institute, and it's my honor to be discussing this film with those who helped make it. So first, I wanted to ask you, Matt, the director of FedSoc at FedSoc Studios, who put together this amazing film. I wanted to ask you about how and why you decided to make this specific documentary. What about this issue drew you to it? What about this issue made you create this sort of film?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having us here at Cato. You guys have an amazing setup and auditorium. Very jealous of that, but thanks for hosting us. It was fantastic. Well, just to give you one quick thing about FedSoc Studios. So we are part of the Federalist Society, and we are the in-house filmmaking team at FedSoc. And so we make a number of documentaries. We also work with other divisions at FedSoc to put on and make cool stuff like this. But as far as your actual question, we started working on this probably 2 years ago. This was before Elon Musk bought Twitter. It was even before, I think, he was even talking about that. So after COVID, after misinformation, but also the government's influence in social media became much more part of the ether of what was going on. So we wanted to make something about that, but we don't make really policy films, but especially not like cultural films. And a lot of it is just, well, do you like social media doing this or not? And so we were waiting to find a legal angle. When Elon Musk took over Twitter, well, that became more interesting because then the Twitter files came out. And so then we started seeing a little bit more of what we could actually do something with. And the whole time we were circling around the question of, well, where's this line between, essentially deputizing a third party and just government speech on its own? As the case with the doctors started going up the circuit courts, we were like, all right, I think we have something here. There's a very definite legal question. And then we started talking to awesome people like Nicole and Will and Kate and Katie, who's out there, and Adam, who wasn't able to make it, as well as many other people. And so then that came together as the general idea of Jawboned. And obviously, jawboning is an interesting term that no one has heard, and it allowed us to animate a cool story on there and get a bad word in the film, too. So that's always fun. Happy to go into it any more than that. But that was the general idea. Wanted to do something on misinformation, but needed to find a good legal theory. And that's what we like to often do, is to find questions where it's hard to find the line, where it's not so much everyone's on one side or the other, but more of everyone's trying to figure out where that line is. We recently did a film called Cats on the Internet about the third-party doctrine, and that was similar, where it's, well, where is this line? So that was the, the impetus for it. It was a long process, but once we actually finally got things kicked off in September, we filmed in December and January and somehow had all this finished at 3:30 in the morning thanks to Alexa, who's the real star of this. She's the assistant director and producer and really did a lot on this. So here we are.
Amazing. And you mentioned this looking for this unique legal angle, and obviously it comes up in the film. We've since had Murthy v. Missouri and Vullo be argued before the Supreme Court. So I want to open up to the whole panel to sort of discuss how do we think those cases went? What were the arguments made? Just a general question of where do we think the court is going with jawboning precedent?
Well, I think whatever they do, it will have to do more with NRA v. Vullo than Murthy v. Missouri. The court seemed to appreciate the clarity of the jawboning attempt in, or real jawboning, wasn't just an attempt, in NRA v. Vullo, where you have Martha Vullo as regulator and jawboner. One person, she's doing it all herself. Compared to the kind of diffuse, inchoate Biden administration efforts around COVID, at the heart of Murthy, where Biden himself says one thing, the threat seems to come from a press secretary rather than someone really empowered to regulate, and whether all of that amounts to coercion is just much blurrier than Maria Vullo herself making these sorts of threats. So doesn't bode well for the court really resolving this in the social media space, but...
Yeah, we all wanted a jawboning opinion in the social media context. As Will Scholarship has explained so ably, there are aspects of like the operations and practices of large social media companies, including their popularity, that pose very precise questions that there's no need for the court to explore in a case about jawboning financial intermediaries, which is what NRA v. Vullo is. But I do think it's will be very exciting and not anticlimactic entirely, because there have been so many copycat Missouri v. Bidens. This is, if I'm remembering correctly, the fifth one that's almost identical. Two others have made their way up to federal appellate courts, and they all not only die on standing, but die on standing in really, really weird ways. So clarity from the court on what the traceability standard is, what the redressability standard is, and when and who can suffer an injury when the government... jawbones, I think, will completely change the landscape of litigation in future.
And Nicole, we mentioned in the film those two court cases, but it's also important to note that there are some other cases that are sort of have related issues of government and expression. And you work at NetChoice, and so these cases are known as the NetChoice cases. How do those cases intersect with these jawboning cases in Vullo and Murthy?
Yeah, so about 3 weeks before the Supreme Court heard the jawboning cases, they heard two other First Amendment cases brought by my organization called NetChoice v. Paxton and Moody v. NetChoice. We brought these in 2021 in response to two laws passed by Texas and Florida, respectively, which would, among other things, they were passed in the wake of Donald Trump's deplatforming, and they would, among other things, require popular social media platforms to publish content that violates their community guidelines. We sued, arguing, among other things, that forcing websites to publish stuff that they don't want to publish violates the First Amendment right to editorial discretion and the First Amendment freedom from compelled speech. And we've been thinking about the NetChoice cases and the jawboning cases, I guess, maybe we'll be thinking about the next social media case that makes it past standing, as really two sides of the same coin, because both concern the permissible extent to which the government can interfere with private editorial processes consistent with the First Amendment. On the one hand, if the court finds in NetChoice's favor that states cannot seize control of private media, but they can, you know, government can continue whispering in their ear to achieve effectively the same result, a holding reaffirming editorial freedom in the NetChoice cases is kind of a hollow one. They can kind of just get around it. On the other hand, if the court finds against us that states effectively replacing private editorial judgment with their local politicians' own under crippling civil penalty does not violate the First Amendment, it seems just inconceivable that like a rudely worded email from HHS possibly could. So that just seems irreconcilable. And also, you know, if the court finds in favor of NetChoice a decision reaffirming the right to editorial judgment, I think that that provides really strong precedent for future websites, I guess, online services to push back against the government if informational communications start crossing the line into something more sinister. So if there is no more doubt that online content moderation is itself First Amendment a protected activity, there can be no doubt that when the government tries to browbeat these private actors into exercising that activity in ways they otherwise wouldn't, is also a First Amendment issue. So past couple years, all the jawboning plaintiffs I'm aware of have been users or states, and they've all of these cases have suffered substantial standing issues. It's possible that a hypothetical post-NetChoice cases suit brought by the jawboned intermediary themselves might be the next phase in jawboning litigation.
Well, another way around that kind of standing issue is greater transparency and disclosure as to how government is communicating with these platforms. I really see that as the best possible, most workable solution to all of this. But because you don't have that information about whose speech has been targeted or whose speech has the government talked to platforms about, most users, when their speech is removed for whatever reason and they think that it might have happened as the result of government pressure, they can't get to the point of litigating that because they don't know whether the government spoke to the platform about their speech or their account or not. And without some proof that the government did, their case will be dismissed before they get to that discovery stage. So legislatively, it's not really something that courts are likely to do or can do on their own. We need disclosure here. The content of government communications to platforms ought to be transparent, and this solves both these messy standing issues and also just helps to clear the air around what exactly is happening. I think that to the extent we even get a few court wins, it will do little to dispel broader concerns about jawboning as a problem because you can't prove a negative. You don't know what else might be happening behind the scenes. You might enjoin one government agency but find that the same sort of pressure is flowing through another in its stead. Disclosure really is the only solution that grabs all.
I think disclosure is such an interesting idea, and that the like intuitive ick that the public feels when they look at or read about these communications is because of the opacity. But I also think there's opacity inherent in communication on popular social media platforms as well. There's like opacity inherent in content moderation at scale. And there's also opacity when you have the speech intermediary that exercises like autonomous editorial judgment on their own. So I think that that's a super interesting idea and probably promising, but there's still like an opacity problem that creates a
like traceability issue.
Well, it's why an NRA v. Volo centric ruling isn't going to touch any of this, because mm-hmm. banks, for the most part, aren't every day bouncing thousands of normal user accounts or user transactions for running afoul of some rule. You don't expect that of them. If your transaction doesn't go through, you think something wrong has gone wrong. With social media, that's different because the platforms, as Nicole points to, are carrying out all kinds of moderation functions behind the scenes all the time. There are lots of rules that your content might have violated in some way, copyright, all of it. And so absent some social media specific grappling with that obscurity, I don't see how you touch it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I know prior to actually working here at Cato, I worked at Meta and I was on the content policy team. And so there were cases where we wanted that information. It was discussed in the film. You want some of that information from government. But that has itself led to even these social media companies and some of the organizations like the Oversight Board, which was set up by Meta to help it think through these difficult questions. They themselves have actually had cases where they saw a case involving drill rap in the UK, and they said, look, the government in the UK, the police, keep coming to Facebook saying, take this content down, it's causing violence in the inner city. And they did the Freedom of Information request and said, well, the police are only asking for certain videos by certain types of people to keep coming down. That seems like a problem. And so even in the public space, but even in the private space, you've seen people like the Oversight Board say, we need transparency because it's the only way for users in that situation to know that their content is coming down because of specific requests by the government that, in this case, seemed biased toward certain perspectives. So I completely agree that the transparency basis approach is sort of essential, and that we're seeing that both from, like I said, from your scholarship, but also even from the likes of the Oversight Board and private entities. One last question, and then I want to open it up to some questions from the audience and online. But I was chatting with you beforehand about some of the unique expressive power of, and this is a little off topic, but just because I'm so interested in it, the power of AI to help create new expression. It's related to this because we do see efforts to regulate AI, efforts to regulate speech that AI can create. And I see in this film, you were telling me about how powerful AI has been in helping you express this perspective. And so can you explain to our audience about how important that AI is and how regulating AI or jawboning people who create AI tools could harm expression?
Yeah, I mean, we used AI a lot in this film. All of the graphics essentially are all AI generated. Our editor, who is awesome anyways, we started doing this in our last film, The Cats on the Internet, Cats with the K, like the Supreme Court case from the 60s. And so that one had lots of animated cats in it, which was cool. And Gene Meyer, president, loves cats. So, you got to do something to get it across the finish line. So we started using this because we're getting illustrations that we couldn't afford the quality of, and we couldn't afford the quantity of. And we get them, it takes 5 minutes or something. There's still extra work to do to make it look right, because it's not perfect, but we would not have been able to afford this. It would have looked nothing like this. So on the other hand,
the music was AI-generated as well, right?
No, the music all came from a site called artlist.io, which is like a stock music site that a lot of filmmakers make. So the music was not, but all of the graphics are. Now the editor still illustrated or animated everything, and there's still a lot of work that goes into it. But yeah, we are adopting AI as much as we can. I kind of think you're going to get left behind in the filmmaking space. It's interesting that it's the creative space that got kind of hit next. But right now, they're fantastic tools. But again, we didn't hire an illustrator as we often would. So, but it makes it so we can make better films for less money. So yeah.
Yeah, amazing. No. We're going to go to some questions from the audience. Got some microphones, I believe. No? We should get some microphones eventually. I'm going to go to a question online first while we sort out the microphones. So a first question from online is, where is it? Here it is. Someone was asking, has it been considered that perhaps the government could create sort of their own sites, use their own speech to make their case and then, you know, with the general public free to compare and contrast, would that not completely avoid the government suggesting, informing, critiquing non-government media? So thoughts on this idea that the government can use its own speech?
I'd like to see the government do more of this, and I think the more you combat jawboning, the more you remove that behind-the-scenes lever, the more it encourages the government to rapidly use its own speech to combat misinfo, foreign propaganda, whatever. I think often it ends up being easier or faster for the government or a government employee to send an email to Facebook complaining about something than to get approval to produce a government communication disputing the fact. And so if you change that balance, there's a quite good book called by Richard Stengel called Information Wars about his time at the State Department. He can't let go of his journalistic lens as he's there. And even though he's often pushing narratives we might not all agree with, he can't do it fast enough. He's hamstrung left and right, and it provides a great window into just how difficult it is for the government to get its message out because of its own internal bureaucracy.
Let's go right here.
Thank you. The film was so educational, but also entertaining. You're truly to be commended for taking an arcane subject matter and a lot of the up-close shots of the actors involved who are truly actors because they're acting in the field, not acting on a film. It was really well done. My question would be whether the effect on AI before the fact also would come into the jawboning context, the notion that Biden's executive order requires this notion of red teaming, so his cabinet ministers will determine whether it's disinformation, whether it's untrustworthy or it's unsafe. And if the social media, if the AI companies realize they're going to be evaluated in the dark, behind the scenes that way, they're probably going to, in advance, voluntarily constrain what the large language models put out. So it isn't an example of something coming out and then being declared that it should be censored, but they'll self-censor. Will that also bring a jawboning claim of some kind if somebody has the guts to stand up to the government?
I think a cognizable claim there is much more difficult to create. The idea that some user is going to be able to sue because the tool wasn't built to the specs that he wanted, whether it's the result of institutional reticence or government pressure, just seems harder. That's not to say it isn't a real problem. On all of or most of these popular AI image gen tools, politicians are treated as essentially a protected class. You cannot create images of them. When I was trying to come up with some jawboning images, even historical stuff, JFK jawboning, didn't want to do it because it didn't want to render JFK for me or any politician. And so I think that's a real problem out there, but maintaining a robust open source AI environment in which people can spin up new tools without government review to generate images of whatever niche subject you need is really the way forward. There are always going to be bugbears and taboos that major firms, whether as a result of government pressure or just fear of social sanction, aren't going to touch, but we can have a diversity of AI image gen tools.
We'll go right there, and then we'll come over here. Right here in the middle, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a really good movie. I'm John Vecchione. I'm counsel of record in the Supreme Court for the individuals in Murthy v. Missouri. And at the oral argument, Kagan and Kavanaugh said that they'd called up all the time to newspapers to jawbone, and Roberts cut in, "I never censored anybody." So I thought that was a funny moment. But one thing you said that I'm very interested in, because I think that the standing is going to, we're going to have standing. And I also think that the cause of action will stay. I think that they may have problems with the injunction. But how much does this stiffen the spine of the actual social media companies? If they say, yes, this is a bad thing, you can sue if you have this, that, and the other thing, and they don't just shut it down. Do you think that will because we were all, I think all the lawyers were stunned by how much the social media had actually resisted this. When we got in, we thought it was all going to be dancing, you know, hand in hand, and that wasn't the case. There was a lot of pushback. But will either of these cases stiffen the spine of social media? I think you said something about it, but I'd like to hear that.
Stiffen the spine. You mean might communications between the social media platforms and the government change?
To resist the jawbone.
Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, Katie right here is probably the best person to ask. But I've been thinking about that. How will communications change in the aftermath of Murthy, even if, you know, the federal government wins? And the very depressing answer is perhaps communications will just take place more over the phone or over Signal because, gee, this is kind of embarrassing. Gosh, I really don't know. That's...
Katie, would you like to speak? Katie is in the audience. Could we get the mic right here?
Yeah, I think that I think it will strengthen the spine in some ways, in terms of feeling more comfortable of pushing back or saying no, even if the government is flagging things. And that was happening even before, right, of that sort of happening. I think the part that what the court cases can't solve is what it does to move public opinion and what public opinion can do in terms of your stock price, how your user base is using it, your competition, things of that nature. And so there's still sort of that bully pulpit that the government has or Congress has and things of that nature that even that can still cause them like reputational harm that I think that they may still be sensitive to. I also think it'll be it's very dependent also on who ends up winning here in November and what Congress looks like and just sort of what the political environment is, because it's definitely ebbed and flowed depending upon who has power in Congress and what sort of questions and pressure they're bringing to the companies.
I wonder if a favorable, of course, resolution of the net choice cases would also serve pretty strongly to stiffen the spine, because if there's no more doubt that what happens in the content moderator's room is no different than what happens in the New York Times, I don't know, editorial, be it a room, office, whatever, they will realize that they do not have to capitulate. This is their First Amendment right. And look, the Supreme Court very recently said it. So that could be a game changer.
I'm going to take a question from online, then we'll jump over here. A related question about how clear is it that government agencies were potentially funding projects that could then flag content or make recommendations to remove content? How does that funding of private actors to engage in flagging or making recommendations about content policies, how does that work with jawboning and, you know, prohibitions on government infringing on the rights of private actors?
I think it depends on how attenuated it is, what the expectations of the flagging program, or, you know, if it is properly considered a flagging program versus something more academic. I worry, frankly, that we end up overfitting our idea of what jawboning is to these sorts of paradigms. We don't want to be saying, well, it's only jawboning if a Stanford academic is involved passing a tip to a government agent who then takes it to Facebook. Otherwise, it's just sparkling censorship. That doesn't get us very far, and ultimately you'll see the kind of pressure jawboning just shift around in where it's coming from. I think most of those academics are already operating under much more transparency and a far greater expectation of transparency or disclosure, because their university emails can often be FOIA'd, they have been subpoenaed. than most of the government actors taking their work and communicating with platforms on the basis of it. And so I think, frankly, you get less pushback around disclosure or transparency from those academic groups than you might expect.
We'll go over here.
Al Milliken, AM Media. Just in the few weeks preceding the 2020 election, I started posting information about Hunter Biden. I had an anonymous letter that I shared and pieces from, I think, New York Post, Guardian. And I got threatened and actually, you know, I just started using Facebook Meta in 2018, and I was increasing friends and followers. And then all of a sudden, yeah, this one got reaction. We lost a lot of friends and followers, but everyone was in denial. But pretty much everything I shared has proven to be true about Hunter Biden and, you know, to a lesser extent, Joe Biden. But ever since then, even though I've increased friends and followers, I know that my posts and what I share doesn't reach more than a handful of people. And I'm just, particularly if you worked at Meta, I'm curious what really happened behind the scenes in the 2020 election.
What I can say is that if there are certainly, and I think almost all the social media companies have to one measure or another said that, and it was even discussed in the film, Twitter very clearly said, you know, we made a mistake. They've all, I think, testified for Congress to this extent. But I think what you're referring to then is that the question of broader questions about how social media companies are transparent or not transparent about some of their own internal policies, especially not just the black and white, we take this content down, we leave this content up, but also the questions around, well, if this content is fact-checked, we decrease the amount that it's distributed, we decrease the amount that it's seen by other people, these sort of soft actions, so it makes you feel like your content isn't being seen. The transparency around that is something that I think a lot of the social media companies are working towards, but they're not there yet. But I do know, actually, just for instance, recently on this front, there was some news, I think, in the past few weeks. There was a dust-up over how Instagram was decreasing political content. But it was actually giving users more choice over how content that was fact-checked, if that would be demoted or whether a user didn't want it to be demoted, essentially giving users more control over whether or not content on their feed should be suppressed or not. I actually think that's a really novel and good idea, because that's saying, okay, if someone wants to see your content and Facebook is demoting it, well, now maybe you can, those people who want to see your content, they can sort of opt in to say, yeah, I don't want to abide by your standards of fact checking. I want to see, you know, your content. So I do think there are efforts being made to get away from or to decrease the to decrease the punishing feel that I think it can have when people perceive that their content is being actioned or being, you know, demoted, but they don't know that they're being shadow banned or whatnot. That's not a good feeling, and I think, like I said, I think social media companies are working to improve that. But once again, that's the area of a private actor deciding how they want to run their store, run their establishment. I think it's best practice to provide users greater control and better transparency. But it's certainly a problem if it was the government saying, please demote your content, please demote this content. And that's the distinction here. We'll go right there.
Could you speak a little bit more as to the remedy that's being sought in these cases, or what sort of legal remedy you think would be appropriate to deal with jawboning? Would this be an injunction against certain kinds of government speech? If you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm frankly an injunction skeptic here, but that is the goal of this litigation. It's to enjoin both types of government speech to private actors, but also speech by particular government agencies. I think even looking at some of the stricter injunctions we got at the lower court stages of Murthy v. Missouri, we see the difficulty in crafting an injunction that both sticks and is not overbroad. The first round of injunction at the district court level seemed on its face to be very strong, overbroad in some people's assessment of it. But at the same time, included an exception for information related to foreign attempts to influence elections through which you could drive any of the kind of Hunter Biden New York Post controversy through. What were platform actions there, but the responses to government warnings about foreign attempts to influence an election. And so I think it will be very hard to come up with a workable injunction here. That isn't to say that an injunction can't do some good on the margin, can't help to clarify this space, given how kind of broad and vacuous the do's and don'ts are at the moment. But I don't think we're going to end up with a line that we're all happy with or can be applied to cases with different sets of facts.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, particularly the district court's injunction, but the Fifth Circuit's as well, like, it illustrates the absurdity of, an injunction's a very blunt instrument, and under what the Fifth Circuit's revised version of it, Louisiana and Missouri, I believe, would be liable for statements that they've made recently about social media platforms, practices, about moderating content related to, for not taking down enough stuff that they believe is harmful to children's welfare, specifically leading up to an act that Louisiana just passed that requires government-issued ID in order to get on social media. So basically those communications leading up to passage of a law, I think, would have been barred under the injunction. It's a blunt instrument that maybe the plaintiffs themselves don't want.
Got a question right there.
Yeah, just to shift direction just a little bit. I've been very concerned about the way some financial institutions have cut off people, closed bank accounts. There was Constantine Kiston in England, and I forget what the bank, and then there was Colin Wright in Reality's Last Stand over the, over the binary gender issue. And that's not, I don't know how closely connected that could be to any government jawboning, but the idea that financial institutions would do something like that under some of the circumstances that I've heard about is really very shocking. I mean, it could, I don't think if I were going to start a Substack myself, I don't think that PayPal would accept me based on what's happened to some other people, some things I would have to say. What is jawboning in this? Why are they behaving this way? I mean, some of the behavior has been very extreme in a few of the cases. If Colin Wright's especially, if you're familiar with that, I just wonder if you know anything about it.
I think it helps to illustrate that the more heavily regulated a given industry is, the more pressure points they have that are exposed to the government, the easier it is to browbeat and jawbone them. We see this clearly in the NRA case. Maria Volo had a lot more to go on in making these threats than Andy Slavitt or anyone else at the White House did, because she could impose all kinds of sanctions and fines and deem certain insurance products to be non-compliant. And so, in general, the tendency is that the more you're exposed to existing regulation, and particularly things that can be interpreted or rely on judgments made outside of Article III courts, the more of a attack surface you have, and the easier it'll be to jawbone you. Financial institutions are obviously some of the most heavily regulated in our society, and as a result, most vulnerable to jawboning.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that financial intermediaries are an incredible way to, like, collaterally censor end speech. And like Will said, Superintendent Volo said that she set out to put the NRA out of business, and she was basically excited because she was an, you know, head of Department of Financial Services. So it's certainly a concern.
Got a question right here.
Billy Easley at Reddit. Will, this is probably most for you, but I'd be glad to hear from other folks on this. When you talk about frameworks of disclosure that Congress could possibly consider, could you go into detail about some of the elements of that you would want to think on, and specifically things like the timing of the disclosure? Where does the obligation lie? Is it on the platform to disclose when contacts have been made, or does the government need to make it? And when should it sort of connect? Is there a difference between a low-level bureaucrat at HHS making an email versus at like an executive level?
Yeah, so the disclosure regime that I've published a model version of Andrew Grossman is really the one responsible for this proposal, but it's called the Censorship Transparency Act. There's a copy on the Knight Foundation website, other versions kicking around. It places the disclosure transparency burden squarely on the state. There are some sort of minor platform notification requirements to inform users when the government has communicated with the platform about their speech, but this is all in response to a government report. The idea is that whenever anyone, any federal government employee, minor or a major player, communicates with social media platforms, the content of their communication should be disclosed through the Office of Budget and Management. It creates another, you know, bureaucratic box to tick when they communicate with these platforms. But I think that having the content of these communications, not merely the fact that it's happened, made public is very important. And, you know, in some situations where there's a national security concern, where it relates to an ongoing law enforcement investigation, you can imagine publishing this on a delay and in the model language, we include provisions for that. There may also be situations like these banking jawboning cases where what the government is pressuring an intermediary about isn't public and isn't something that you want to be public. It's one thing when you're publishing things on Twitter. Obviously, you want everyone to see that. But if the government is coming after your bank account because you've supported some subversive organization, or you've been publishing books that they don't like, you might want to be pseudonymous there. You don't want it to be known that you're the financial backer of these things, and so you don't want then the government, in disclosing its jawboning or communication with your bank, to also out you as the holder of an account that you hadn't publicly claimed. So that's basically the gist, kind of why those proposed contours exist. But it's be another, you know, burden that falls on state employees that you'd hope would, on the margins, discourage them from jawboning or making audacious requests. You know, you'd like to know about the request that happens so you can sue over them if they cross the line, but ideally, you'd like the bullying request to just never be made in the first place. And a lot of what came out in the Twitter files, especially the most worrying language there, when people started to sound mafia-like, you have to expect that if there is an understanding that would come out, that would be made public, the language probably wouldn't have been used in the first place. In many cases, the email wouldn't have been sent in the first place. And so that's another real benefit of that approach. Happy to take follow-ups.
Another question from online is for you. It's a question of, first of all, they say They had no idea that FedSoc produced such incredible films, so there you go. The question that they have is basically, what are you working on next? They can't wait to watch. So do you care to give some sneak peeks to folks about what else they could expect from you guys?
Absolutely. So first of all, we do have films. We do have documentaries. We probably have 40 or 50 on YouTube, all between 10 and 20 minutes on every topic from Roe v. Wade to medical marijuana to this and that and whatever. We have several more in the works. We're usually releasing 5 to 7 per year. So the next one's coming out is our senior producer, Ann Hartley, is working on Bush v. Gore. And it's with Ted Olson and David Boyce, so just the two litigators on opposite sides telling the story. So we're hoping to have that out in June before it gets too close to the election, and it has become much more relevant all of a sudden. We've been working on this for probably a year and a half or so. So that's one of them. Guy, who's back there somewhere, he's our assistant editor, and he came up with a cool way to make antitrust interesting, which we're always struggling to find, which is the Paramount decrees from the late 40s or 50s that basically broke up the vertical integration of old Hollywood. Those have been rescinded recently, and now there's the vertical integration of streaming platforms. So we hope that that will be interesting to people, more interesting than most antitrust. And then Alexa, who was our assistant director, producer, and writer of this film, she's working on music copyright, and that should be fun. We rented a piano and a piano tuner, and I had to explain to Gene why we're paying for a piano tuner, but it should be a lot of fun also. We have a lot. We have one coming out on Buck v. Bell. That was the forced sterilization case from the 20s, so we've been working on that one for a while, so we have a lot. And then on the regulatory transparency project side, which is RTP, part of FedSoc, their films are also part of our studio system. And theirs are usually shorter and more kind of debatey and more focused on regulations. We have a few cool things coming out. We have one called Shaped, and it's how regulations shape the world around us. The first one's going to be on cars, on CAFE standards, but also the crossover to electric vehicles and what that's going to look like. It's the largest change of technology, and it's the first one that's kind of actually public directed, unlike when we went from horses to cars. So that's one episode. The second one is on medical innovation, and that one should be really cool. We're going to be most likely looking at the FDA's review and potential approval of MDMA for therapeutics. And then the final one is on AI, and that's going to be more so the CAFE one is sort of looking back. The medical one is like right now, and AI is kind of looking forward. What are we going to do? And the main focus there is decentralized versus centralized, and open source versus not open source, yeah. And which direction we will go, which is interesting because Elon Musk started his own company, assuming OpenAI and all that. And then we're going to have other ones too, so I could ramble on for a while. But we got a lot of stuff.
There you go.
And it's all on our YouTube channel. And this will be out tomorrow on our YouTube channel as well. So check it out. And don't forget to subscribe. We also have a FedSoc Films podcast where we follow up on stuff. And we have a podcast on this coming out with Eric Jaffe. And it's really neat. It goes into all of the little nitty-gritty. Well, what about if it was this? Or what about if it was this? Okay, well, what if it's not government? You know. So that one will be fun. So anyways, there's all the shameless self-promotion.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm going to give the panelists just a last moment just to opine about something else that they liked about the film, that we haven't discussed yet, something related to the film, just closing thoughts.
Ooh, compliments.
Well, again, disclosure. I'll just make my, beat that dead horse a little bit more. I loved the animations around aphorism and fun turns of phrase, whether it's Goldilocks or pre-pruning or the baby in the bathwater.
That was all you guys giving us really good examples we could illustrate.
Yeah, but I didn't think they'd visually come to life that way, so I love that. And really, many thanks to Alexa, who has shepherded this project all the way through and helped me to get involved when I ran into her on a train going to New York. She was reading one of my jawboning papers. I was getting a drink, and
she does that 24/7. So yeah, that was just like a coincidence.
And we just have her ride the Amtrak back and forth,
looking for people. Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for including me in all this.
And she is dressed like misinformation.
Oh, me. yes. No. Okay. Honestly, this was million thanks to Matt and Alexa. Seriously, this is like the coolest professional project I've had the honor and privilege to be a part of. And especially, it's very cool for me to be co-interviewing with Will because I was his intern 4 years ago on the jawboning paper. If you see any egregious formatting issues on the appendix with all of the amazing jawboning examples, that's probably me. So this is just incredibly rad, and you guys did truly a tremendous job.
Thank you. We try to make law cool.
Well, I think you did that, and so I just want to have our audience thank our amazing panel for the film. And now we should have some drinks and snacks out in the lobby. So thank you for joining us, and we'll see you out front.
Reception continues.